the four-day wall-to-wall guitar festival. Visit CranitCenter.com for information on the entire season.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Certainly one thing we know is that hip-hop and hip-hop culture is something that has its roots in black urban America. However, we also know that it has come to be very popular in white suburban America. It certainly has become an enormous commercial force in the United States. However, there is another facet to this, as hip-hop has indeed become a real cultural and political movement, something that perhaps hasn't been subject to as much analysis as its commercial impact. Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we're going to do that, and we'll be talking with someone who is recognized as being perhaps one of the leading authorities, often quoted on hip-hop culture. His name is Bakari Kitwana. He has authored a couple of books, including a new one, which is just out, titled Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop. He, in fact, was here in Champaign-Urbana on the U of I campus not very long ago and was here in the studio with us to talk. And I think at that time we said when the new book came out, we'd like to talk again. And he said, sure, he'd be happy to do that. He's now spending some time traveling around the country talking about his new book, which has now been out, I think, just almost a matter of days. It's published by Basic Books. He's out on the West Coast. He's in San Francisco and spending some time with us this morning on the telephone to talk. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Bakari Kitwana, was the executive editor of The Source, the country's best-selling music magazine for much of the 90s. He also served as editorial director at Third World Press and as a music reviewer for NPR's All Things Considered. He has also contributed to a number of publications, including The Village Voice, The Source, and The Progressive. His weekly column, Do the Knowledge, is published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And his previous book, which is also out and available in bookstores if you would like to take a look at it, is entitled The Hip-Hop Generation. And as I said, he's joining us this morning by telephone. Bakari, hello.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Maybe just a basic point to start out with. I'm sure that many people would point out just how influential African-American music has been as a part of American culture for going back a long time. Certainly has been true of blues and its influence on rock and roll and so forth and so on, even going back in American popular music, jazz, ragtime, and other forms. And so I think that some people might, on the one hand, say the popularity of hip-hop music with white kids certainly shouldn't be a surprise, and that maybe we should expect to see what has happened before, which is a kind of appropriation of that item of culture, and in fact, might see one of those cases as we have in the past, where it ended up that white entrepreneurs and white artists ended up taking what essentially was a black musical form, taking it over, making it theirs, making the money, and coming out the winners. And we've seen that pattern before. I think, though, that you're prepared to argue that maybe hip-hop might follow a different pattern.
Yeah, I think that hip-hop will follow a different pattern. I think the dynamics are different. I think we're in a different time. But what I think is important about the book, Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop, is that I think that when our starting point is look at what happened with race and black music before, then I think we're not giving ourselves an opportunity to have a discussion about what's happening that's new. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a new time. I think it's a new time for the way that music is transmitted internationally. I think it's a new time because of the power and impact of satellite and cable, television, and et cetera. But I also think that it when you talk about it that way, you don't see hip-hop beyond just being a music. And hip-hop is a cultural movement, and that cultural movement means a lot, and there's a lot of dimensions to it, which I hope we can get into.
Sure. Well, when we take, when you ask just the basic question of who is listening to hip-hop, it certainly has a very broad appeal that cuts across race lines, and we know that there are black kids who listen and white kids who listen and Asian kids who listen and Latino kids who listen, and it doesn't seem to break down according to race, but cut across it. What do we know about who is listening to hip-hop, in particular the percentage of the audience that's white?
Right. Well, I think we know less than we think we know. I think that the word on the media vine is that 70 or 80% of hip-hop's audience is white. This is a statistic that I talk about in great detail in the book, in a chapter entitled Are White Teens Really Hip-Hop's Primary Audience? Because I think that it has not been studied. And in the book, Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop, I document who has done this kind of research. Most of the people who claim this in media, whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or Fox Television, they refer back to the record label executives. When you talk to record label executives, they refer back to SoundScan. When you talk to SoundScan says they only record over-the-counter data. They don't record demographic data. And so it's interesting that this idea that white kids by most hip-hop is something that's just so readily accepted. It's probably one of the most well-known things about hip-hop, which actually isn't even documented.
Hmm. Well, why would to people who are in the industry, what's the appeal of an idea like that?
Well, I think the appeal is there was a time when first of all, I think it's a racist assumption to begin with, but I think that there was a time in hip-hop when hip-hop was growing and it was suffering severely by, you know, the police response to concerts. And a lot of concerts were being shut down in the late 80s and the early 90s because, there was this fear of too many black kids getting together. Mm. And so there was a clear shift amongst people marketing music, amongst party promoters, to shift the audience and to shift the venues. I talk about this in some detail in the book, and I think that in the process of doing that, I think the audience has also shifted.
There, one of the things that seems to preoccupy people is this question. I guess, for want of a better word, it's a kind of an authenticity question. That is, who created the music? Whose is it? And if that shifts over time, then what does that mean for the music? Does that mean, for example, if it turns out to be true that the majority of the audience for the hip hop is white, I guess one would have to ask the question, well, so what? I mean, does that, as specifically as regards the music, does that somehow then change the music? Does it change the message? Does it change what it means? If you have an art form that's essentially created by one group of people, if it's embraced by somebody else,
right?
Is that either good or bad, or you just say, well, that just is. It isn't really one or the other.
I think that it has a lot to do with power and influence. If you're saying that white kids buy most rap music, and if you're also saying that rap music is pimps, players, bees, and hoes, as it's portrayed via VH1 and BET and Clear Channel and Radio 1, then if you're saying that white kids are buying most of that music, then it fits a nice package of America's old racial politics. Young white kids who are somehow taking part and enjoying this continuation of white supremacy. I don't agree with that, and I don't think that that's what's going on, and I think that people who want to present that image don't want to deal with the fact that young Americans born after the Civil Rights Movement have lived their entire lives in post-segregation America, and black and white kids, Asian American kids, Native American kids, Latino American kids are processing race radically different than our parents' generation.
And you think that music has something to do with that?
I think that the cultural movement of hip-hop has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
The music of hip-hop, which came out of hip-hop culture in the South Bronx in the early 70s has moved around the country and moved around the world because of the power and influence of American corporations and just and commerce. And so this music has moved the culture into a national phenomenon. So you have a cultural movement around the country and around the world where young people are making their own music, young people are creating breakdancing collectives and spoken word collectives, young party promoters are throwing hip-hop parties, and young DJs are making mixtapes. And you have this phenomenon, young hip-hop activists engaging in activism, you have this phenomenon around the country. So the music has been a driving force for creating a national cultural movement. And I think the cultural movement is very local. It's national and local, but what we see is the national presentation, which is the distortion of hip-hop by corporatization. And I think there's a difference.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with writer Bakari Kitwana, who has written a lot about hip-hop culture. He was executive editor of The Source. That was the country's best-selling music magazine for much of the 90s. He's also served as editorial director at Third World Press and has written for a number of different publications. He's the author of two books, Hip-Hop Generation, and a new book, which has just been published, titled Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop, and it's published by Basic Books. And he's out on the West Coast this morning. He's been traveling around talking about the book, and questions, comments from people who are listening, they are certainly welcome. All you need to do is call us, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I think we know generally what our people will know what hip-hop music is. And in a superficial level, if you use a phrase like hip-hop culture, I suppose people immediately will think about styles of dress and use of language and gesture and attitude, all very kind of surface things. But if I ask the question and we try to go to a deeper level about hip-hop culture, how do you define that? When you talk about hip-hop culture, what do you mean?
Right. That's a good question, and I think it's an important question, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to really flesh it out. When we're talking about culture, we're talking about, the pioneers would define hip-hop culture as graffiti art, breakdancing, rapping, and DJing. The commercialization of rap music expands those definitions. So now we're talking about verbal language, we're talking about body language, we're talking about style, we're talking about clothing, we're talking about attitude, we're talking about an entire worldview. The best way, I think, for people who are outside the culture to get it is when you make a comparison to, say, civil rights movement in the civil rights era, and there was a civil rights culture that went with that. So you could be a young person, 15 or 16, involved in an activist organization in the 60s or in the 70s or even in the 50s. That was a part of the youth culture of the time. Hip-hop is the youth culture of this time, and as a culture, it has a political imperative, it has an economic imperative, it has a spiritual imperative. And I think that those dimensions of hip-hop are lost in the commercialization of it. All we mostly see in the commercialization of hip-hop in mainstream hip-hop, those artists that are selling 1.4 million CDs in 4 days, that was the case of The Massacre by 50 Cent. What we're seeing is sex and violence, which is a part of American entertainment. It's not a hip-hop thing. It's an American entertainment thing. Of course, you get artists that break through that, and they're exceptions. And even artists like 50 Cent, I would say, there are some exceptions to that formula. But that is the dominant formula in that context. What people are missing who aren't a part of the culture is what's going on off the radar. And it's a lot. It's a lot going on off the radar. You can look at artists like Aesop Rock or Sage Francis or Atmosphere. These are white hip-hop artists who most people have never even heard of who are selling about 100,000 CDs per release. This is huge. These artists are touring around the country doing something like 200 concerts or more a year around the country in venues anywhere from the size of about 200 to 1,500. And these artists are having a huge impact. There are black artists in that same realm. Many of them are political in their content. And these artists are, you know, doing the same number of concerts. But again, the racial dynamic falls into play because these artists are not selling as much as their white counterparts. and the audience that they're performing for is 95% white, which isn't the case of someone like 50 Cent or Eminem, where the audience is a lot more diverse. It could be 50% white, it could be 40% white in some cities, it could be 60% white in some cities. You start to get a sense of a little bit of a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is it that it makes it sound as if you would say that white audiences are more accepting of a black performer in a sense? I mean, they're more willing to buy that person's CDs and go to see that person than is the black audience to do that same thing with a white performer?
This is interesting. I don't think that's what I'm saying, but I guess that's what I just said.
Yeah, it sounded like that.
I think that it's complicated. I mean, I think there's a lot of layers to it. Some of the artists that I mentioned who are selling well in the quote-unquote underground, but basically what they are independent artists who aren't signed to a major record label. These artists are what some people like to believe are a new avant-garde in hip-hop. And the style and the style of their music is a little bit different. You look at it doesn't have the same hit music sound and appearance as some of the mainstream black artists. But at the same time, you take someone like Eminem, who does fit that mold, and he is selling to a lot of black kids as well as white. But again, you can't. It's difficult to pin down when there's no one documenting the audience. But what I do see is there are other indicators. For example, when I worked at The Source, we did demographic surveys of our readers, and we often found that at the high end, our audience was 40% white in terms of the magazines who we were selling to. So it seemed far-fetched to me that The Source, a magazine that at its height was selling over 500,000 magazines a month, that it could be that far different for music to be selling to 70 or 80% white kids.
Hmm. Well, I can understand that part of this does involve the issue of within any kind of art form you're talking about, there's a mainstream, which is always going to be the most popular, perhaps the most accessible, and then there'll be an avant-garde. And for those people who are doing things that are a little bit different, maybe a little bit more difficult, maybe not as accessible, their appeal is not going to be as great, and that's kind of always the way that it's been, no matter what kind of art form you're talking about.
I think you also have what you have is within America, I think today, amongst a lot of white kids, many of whom I talk to a lot of white kids across the country in the book. I talk to kids in Oregon. I talk to kids in Montana. I talk to hip-hop kids in Gainesville, Florida, in Salt Lake City, Utah, in Minneapolis. And you start to get, a sense of where kids' heads are. A lot of kids who are into hip-hop and who are young are looking for a counterculture, are looking for an oppositional identity, and they're finding that in hip-hop. And so as they begin to seek out artists, a lot of kids who are in that mind frame are looking for artists who aren't commercial. They want artists who are going against the grain. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, one of the things I talk about in the book is that hip-hop has become the new alternative music. For many years in rock and roll, you could find an aspect of rock and roll that represented counterculture, whether it was the punk movement, whether it was the grunge movement. But with the decline of both of those movements, many of those kids are now getting into hip-hop. And hip-hop, really, within the industry, has been marketed and promoted as the new alternative music.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about this idea that hip-hop and hip-hop culture is going to have an influence or has already had an influence on the way people, and particularly young people, think about race.
Okay. This is a good one. Again, this is layered stuff. how has hip-hop changed the way? To me, I'll give the example of The Source battle with Eminem, which I have a chapter dedicated to in the book. I think that it's impossible to continue to talk about race the same way after hip-hop. I think that when The Source began to attack Eminem and say that he is the Elvis of hip-hop, it just doesn't make any sense, especially for a magazine who has been at the forefront, really, of advancing the idea of a hip-hop cultural movement. And so the idea that white kids, that Eminem, for example, who grew up as poor as many black artists, somehow is just benefiting and stealing hip-hop in the same way that Elvis stole rock and roll when Eminem constantly in his racial analysis in terms of his lyrics, I think he's far more sophisticated than many artists, and I think that he understands that there is a new racial politics, and you hear it in the music, the way that he processes race, the way that the racial critique. Now, in terms of the other music beyond that, I think that he's average. I think that people who think that he's the best rapper ever haven't listened to that much hip-hop. And so I think that he, in terms of his racial analysis, so I think he's at the forefront. If you listen to a lot of things that he's saying on the song White America, if you listen to a lot of things that he's saying on the song Mosh, it's a very sophisticated racial analysis. I think there is a new racial politics that is emerging with this generation because of the impact of the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement. You have young white kids vastly more familiar with black culture than white kids of any other generation. Because of the impact of African Americans in terms of popular culture in this country, et cetera, because of the changing music scene, because you have more white kids in America today who I think are facing that there is a declining sense of amongst young white kids of white skin privilege. And so I think that because of all these variables, you're starting to get a new way of thinking about race because of the immigration from many different communities from around the world in our lifetime. I think that we're starting to just process race and think through race differently. This isn't the first time that I think that we've seen a new racial politics in America. We've seen it before. What's unique about this moment is there is an institutional structure, hip-hop, embedded in the culture of America, embedded in the society because of the effect of commerce, that is allowing for the ideas that are being set forth in terms of race that are different to have force. Same thing happened with the abolitionist movement. The same thing happened with the civil rights movement. And because of that, we saw great dramatic changes in the country after those movements. And I think the same thing will happen because of hip-hop.
Yeah. Well, a number of years ago, I was having a conversation with music writer Nelson George. And he was the first person I ever heard, it was in this conversation, to use the term white Negro. And he was talking about this very thing we're talking about, that is performers who have been accused of, and maybe rightly accused of, appropriating black culture and gesture and music. And probably the original white Negro was Elvis Presley. And there are others. Now, I don't know if he made up that term or somebody else
did. Well, he did make it up. Norman Mailer.
Norman Mailer did that. All right. Yeah. Well, so anyway, it was Nelson that was the first person I ever heard use the term. And I guess I'm sort of curious about how you, if you say somebody like Eminem is at least expressing a culture that really is in many ways his. I mean, it comes out of a sort of environment out of which he grew. How do you think about a term like that? Does a term like that really mean something? And how do you sort out somebody who, in a sense, is really doing something that comes out of what they came from, and somebody who is just stealing something because it seems to have commercial potential?
I talk in the book in that chapter, which is I use the term culture bandit, and the title of the chapter is Fear of a Culture Bandit.
Right.
I make a distinction between someone who is stealing culture and someone who is appropriating culture and acknowledging where they got it from. That's a very big difference. If you're selling what they used to call race records, which was, black people making black music or white people making black music, and then the packaging had white people on the covers, but it was black artists that was making the music, the implications are vastly different. I think that Eminem is an artist who acknowledges where he came from, and I think that you start to get into some of the one of the things I try to do in the book is to talk about economics in great detail, because the economics tells a big part of the story of a lot of what happens in America. And in terms of this changing economy, as we moved into the global economy in the late 60s and the early 70s, we saw manufacturing jobs going overseas. We saw education cuts in some of the schools. We saw the rise of incarceration. And I think that what we had then was young African Americans and other people of color from throughout the Caribbean beginning to create a music and a culture that was responding to how do you survive the downsides of globalization? How do you deal with the reality as a young person that the best job you can get in America graduating from high school is to go into the military? How do you deal with that reality? So hip-hop becomes a response to that. I think as globalization has escalated, now we have a reality where middle-class people, black and white, those jobs are now being outsourced in the same way that manufacturing jobs are being sent overseas in the late 60s and early 70s. And so what I talk about in the book is that in many cases, you're starting to get the same sense or growing sense of alienation from mainstream American life amongst a lot of white American youth, Asian American youth, Latino Americans, Native Americans, et cetera. And that is, to me, what explains the draw to hip-hop, not just nationally, but internationally.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bakari Kidwana. He's written a lot about hip-hop culture. He has done work for various publications, including Village Voice, The Progressive. His weekly column, Do the Knowledge, is published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He is the author of two books, The Hip-Hop Generation, and his newest that's just out, Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop. It's published by Basic Books. He was executive editor of The Source, the country's best-selling music magazine for much of the 90s. He's also served as editorial director at Third World Press and also as music reviewer for NPR's All Things Considered. As we continue to talk, we're about our midpoint. Questions are welcome. Anybody who is listening and wants to get in on the conversation can do that by calling us 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. One of the things that you and I talked about when you were here last was the increasing involvement of people who were in the hip-hop world in politics. And the idea that here we had within hip-hop culture, people who were attracted to hip-hop was a potential political voting bloc, something that could be organized.
Right.
We talked a little bit about that and efforts to organize in the run-up to the 2004 elections.
Right.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where things stand right at the moment and if that's something that is continuing to happen.
Yeah, that's a good question. It is something that's still happening. I talk about this some in the book. I have a chapter, the last chapter, where I talk about the activism that took place at a national level around the 2004 election. I talk in great detail about what I call white hip-hop activists. And I believe that these young white hip-hop activists are at the forefront in terms of defining and creating a framework for young white kids who are into hip-hop to begin to think through some of these questions. There's a writer who I interview in the book. His name is Billy Wimsatt. He founded an organization called the League of Pissed Off Voters, along with a woman named Kyle Stewart, who's an attorney out of L.A. Billy wrote a book in 1994 called Bomb the Suburbs. Billy is a white kid from Chicago, Hyde Park. His parents were professors at the University of Chicago. He later on was a student at Oberlin. He grew up as a graffiti writer. And he talks about the responsibility of white kids who are growing up in hip-hop. And this was 1994. A lot has changed since 94, but I think a lot of what he has to say is still accurate. But people like Billy and people like Kyle and people like Wendy Day and others who I interview in the book, I think are beginning to define what it means to be a white hip-hop activist. And so I talk about that in the book. I talk about some of the people who I interviewed were children of activists. Some of the people who I interviewed were in the punk rock movement and were older and later on got into hip-hop. Some of the kids got into hip-hop first, and hip-hop led them to politics because of the content and theme of hip-hop. So you start to get a range of the political thought that's out there amongst a lot of young white kids who are trying to get engaged in this hip-hop political movement, which right now on the surface seems to be mostly black. And I made the comparison of this to the early days of hip-hop concerts, which were mostly black, because it wasn't a space where white kids felt welcome. So organizations like the League of Pissed Off Voters, I think, they're starting to create a space where white kids who are into hip-hop and politics can feel comfortable coming into the hip-hop political movement, because if you ever attended events like the Hip-Hop Summit Action Network, these events are like 99% black, and you would think that white kids who are into hip-hop aren't political. So I try to lay some of these issues out in the book.
Yeah. Well, we have some callers to bring in. Let's do that. We'll start with someone listening in Champaign. And line one. Hello.
Yes. I wanted to make a comment about what you had asked earlier about the difference between some of the artists that are appropriating the music and some of the artists that are stealing it.
Right.
Two names, Vanilla Ice and Eminem. The difference between the two, that's pretty much the answer to that question right there. And I'd like to ask the gentleman on what does rock music have as far as any kind of impact on the hip-hop culture?
That's a good question. What I see in terms of rock's impact on hip-hop, most certainly you see it in some of the sampling. I think you're starting to see it in groups teaming up like Linkin Park and Jay-Z, which really isn't anything new because Run-DMC did the same thing, and other groups have done it since. But what I see that's different in terms of the crossing over and the mingling of rock and rap is, and this is an article that I reference in the book from a professor, I think his name is Bill Usman, but he talks about white rap groups or white rock/rap groups borrowing from hip-hop, and he talks about this as a way of displacing blackness. So this particular writer takes the position that these attempts to combine rock and rap are an attempt to keep and maintain white supremacy. So even though you're dealing with rap, you're dealing with it in a way that rap music and black artists are kind of being pushed to the side. He also used the expression expunging blackness and expunging black signifiers. I agree with this to a certain extent, but I think that the image of hip-hop is so strongly associated with African-Americans that it would take an army of Eminems to change that.
Yeah. That's good.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to somebody else here. This is a caller in Crete on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, my philosophy is that the more the parents hate it, the more the teenagers love it, and I think that's one of the more important aspects for jazz, rock and roll, and hip-hop. But I have a series of questions regarding violence. It seems as a constant reminder of this violent phenomenon almost on a bi-monthly basis of shootouts at studios, people being shot in cars, etc. Almost the East-West Civil War going on, like we had one in the 1860s, North-South. Also, the question of the mafia, the words mafia and the record companies and Gotti and things like that, and the issue of how much does the mafia have an influence on hip-hop recording sessions, etc.
All righty. This is interesting. let's see. I think that the FBI and local law enforcement have done such an excellent job monitoring hip-hop artists that I don't think that anyone has anything to fear about hip-hop getting out of control in a violent way. I think that the violence in hip-hop in the media is overblown. For a long time, before hip-hop really became mainstream American culture, violence was the only time when the media even talked about hip-hop. What I see happening now, there's an organization that monitors violence at concerts. And it shows that violence is down, and they monitor it internationally. Rap music figures into that statistic, but not in a major way. I think it was something like 50% of the incidents or less were at rap concerts. And I think you're talking about the last report showed like 25 incidents internationally that they could point to. So I think that this is something that the media over, builds up beyond what it is. In terms of the references to the mafia and Gotti and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I think it's a sensational attempt to sell records. And, you know, violence sells in America. And so, I mean, I think that's what it is. I think that it's something that I think is damaging for our young people, and it's something that I think that we should fight at an entertainment level. I think when we fight it at just a hip-hop-only level, then we get into blaming young black kids once again for America's problems. I'm for the country taking a stand and setting a standard for violence and sex and entertainment. I think it's inappropriate that we allow this stuff to be marketed to our children, and I think we should do something about it. But I think it has to be done at an entertainment level, not just a hip-hop level.
What have you heard about the mafia's influence on the record companies or some of the stars of hip-hop?
What I have seen is more, you know, I think that there is a more influence of people who are involved in the drug scene trying to make their money legal, more so than a mafia-specific connection. I'm not familiar with anything like that other than, you know, what I've seen in terms of if you look at a lot of the emergence of hip-hop films, and a lot of the hip-hop films celebrate and make reference to some of the mafia-oriented films, you know, films like The Godfather, films like, you know, just gang cultures, films like Scarface. And to me, what I see is a celebration of an underdog character who kind of rises against the odds, who isn't supposed to make it, who is an outcast from America. And that is, in part, the American story, and it's something that I think a lot of young kids are feeling as they feel alienated from mainstream American life.
Final question. Do you see any East-West hostility between the East Coast, New York, and California?
I think a lot of that stuff is overblown. I think it was overblown back when it was a real... back when they had the when there was Tupac and Biggie, you know, battling on wax,
mm-hmm.
I thought that there were some elements of that was real, but you know, in the midst of even all that, these artists were being monitored by the FBI, and this is documented, so it's not just some conspiracy theory. You had police officers in the entourage of off-duty officers in the entourage of both Biggie and Tupac, so. I think that a lot of this stuff needs to be analyzed at a greater level. I don't think that there is an East Coast, West Coast war, and it never has been. There's been a handful of artists who had beef with the artists, another handful of artists, and I don't think it signifies an entire city, and it definitely doesn't signify an entire coast.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to, we have another cell phone, or someone calling here on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying the show. I'm going to go ahead and ask my question and then hang up and listen to the response. I think one of the things that in these times really gives me hope for the possibility of widespread political change is the power of hip-hop, I think, to bring young people together, young people from you know, different geographical locations, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and you know, really with I think it has the potential to bring them together and to create really some powerful changes in our political system. I think what's challenging for me as someone who's not that familiar with hip hop is I guess the fact that most of what I hear really seems to be stuck in the kind of glorification of the violent lifestyle that that doesn't really lead anywhere, and that one really has to dig deep to try to find more you know, more politically aware, politically oriented hip hop. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were about that, and maybe if you had recommendations, specific recommendations for listeners who are interested in exploring more political hip hop, and then also just what your thoughts are as far as whether or not you see the hip hop movement moving as a whole into a more sort of politically aware and politically engaged process. Thanks.
Wow,
I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Okay.
Well, that's a lot. Can I write a dissertation on this? Let me see. I think that in your opening comments, you're right on target, and I think what you're saying is accurate, and I think that that is what's happening, and I think it is very powerful, and, you know, people don't want to deal with that. In terms of how can I respond to that? Nellyville, for example, sold 9 million CDs to date. The Massacre by 50 Cent sold 1.4 million CDs in 4 days. I think the potential of translating those numbers into political power is very real and very possible, and that's what the hip-hop political movement is about. And so I think many activists on the ground locally have been involved in this process, you know, going back 10 or 15 years. What we have more recently are a handful of groups trying to take that to a national level. There's a group that just emerged recently called the Hip Hop Caucus out of Washington, D.C., that's doing some real interesting work. But in terms of recommendation for the point you made about the what you mostly see, I mean, again, we get back to setting a standard as a country for the entertainment industry. I mean, I think this whole idea of the consolidation of American entertainment in the hands of a handful of corporations is a part of the problem. You do have some local radio stations that are, you know, wising up and letting artists get on the air, so you're getting more circulation. But I think that in terms of finding out this information, I think you do have to dig. But I think there are a lot more opportunities than they used to be in terms of digging. There are mixtape DJs who are, you know, concentrating just on politics. There's a DJ out of North Carolina. Her name is MC Shayla, and she has a website. I think it's mcshayla.com. Her stuff is very political. She is making mixtapes that has a range of artists on there. Some of them I've never even heard of. So I think that, and the stuff is incredible. You think about artists like Immortal Technique, artists like Brother Ali out of Minneapolis, artists like Mr. Lift and Acrobatic out of Boston. These artists, I think, are delving deep with the politics in a real strong political conversation. So I see the movement, I think it's very viable. I think that a lot of people are fed up. In the book, what I talk about is the Harold Washington election in 1983, and I show the similarities between the climate then for those people who were outside of the process, many of whom hadn't voted before, and I make these comparisons to the climate now with hip-hop. And that was a very cross-racial movement to elect Harold Washington, and it was a very cross-racial and cross-cultural government. And I think we can do the same thing with hip-hop if we look and learn from that example.
Does that? I hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Let's go on here. We have another caller, and this is Urbana Line 2.
Yeah, good morning. Fascinating show. What about women in hip-hop? Do you think you'll write a book just about women in hip-hop and how they process the information they're bringing to their listeners and how they write it and who listens specifically to women hip-hop?
Right. That's a good question. I think that I'm working on a piece on women in hip-hop. It's called Ain't No Love, Does Hip-Hop Hate Black Women? But there are other pieces out already that are circulating that I think are important. There's a book out by Mark Anthony Neal called New Black Man. And in the last chapter, he talks in detail about representations of women in hip-hop. There's a new book coming out by a professor at who's the head of Black Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her name is Tracy Sharpley Whiting. The book is entitled Pimps Up, Hoes Down. And then there's Joan Morgan's book, When Chickenheads Come Home to Roost. So there's a lot of information out there. There's a book by Gwendolyn Poe, which is called Check It While I Wreck It, which deals with the impact of women on hip-hop. So there's a lot of information out there already, and I think there's more coming. I think that it is problematic, the representation of women, and I see more and more a resistance and a response to it. One of the trends that I see, most certainly in the underground and at the independent artist level, is there are more women coming to the shows than there used to be. People talk about the rise of a white audience. I think that that's an element. But another element that people aren't talking about is a rise of a younger audience of hip-hop kids coming to concerts and a rise of women coming to independent concerts. So I see some interesting trends. I see women around the country protesting and responding to the negative representations of women, and I think that's going to have an impact. I think that this will inevitably be a part of any significant hip-hop political movement.
We got about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. I'm sure we'd get one or two more callers in if people wanted to call real quick. Our guest this morning is Bakari Kitwana. He's a writer, has written a lot about hip-hop culture. He's the author of two books, The Hip-Hop Generation, and the brand new one. It's titled Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop. It's published by Basic books. One thing I you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that hip hop culture has certain imperatives, political, economic, and spiritual.
Right.
And we've touched on some of those a little bit, except maybe the third one. Tell me, what are the spiritual imperatives of hip hop?
I'm working on a new book also with a young minister. His name is Jeff Johnson. The book is looking at Christianity and hip-hop, where we kind of get into a lot of these issues. In terms of the spiritual imperative, I think that this is one of the things that's kind of been left off the radar, along with a lot of other things happening in hip-hop. But if you start to listen intensely to the music, you start to pick up on a lot of spiritual references, a lot of searching amongst young people for a spiritual center. And I think that hip-hop is offering answers in those areas. Even if you listen to an artist like 50 Cent, he's talking about God alongside of a lot of other crazy things, but you start to see a pattern in the music where young people are raising the question. The other thing that's going on that, again, is beneath the radar is the emergence of a number of hip-hop ministries around the country. Young people in the church, tired of not enough young people being in the church, are beginning to young ministers and tired of the old guard not allowing hip-hop into the church, are doing a lot of creative things in terms of creating hip-hop ministries. There's a church in Baltimore called Empowerment Temple, a huge following in the thousands. Church is less than a year old. They have a DJ on Sunday morning. You have, I think it's Curtis Blow is doing a ministry similar to that. You also have Mace, who was with Bad Boy, who left and started a church. You have a ministry in Chicago. I think they call it The House under Minister Phil Jackson and others around the country. So you're starting – this is one of the trends that I see is the emergence of the hip-hop ministry where young people are creating churches that speak to hip-hop as a youth culture and incorporating the church and a spiritual dimension into that.
One of the things I think is really interesting in when you're making this argument about the power of hip-hop culture to bring together people across lines of race who maybe have common experiences, what it suggests to me is that one of the things that it maybe has the power to do is to get people thinking about and talking about something in this country that we don't think about and talk about very much, and that's class.
Right.
And I wonder to what extent you think hip-hop really does it deal with that. And does it deal with that in a way that's really obvious so that people know that is what they are talking about?
I think so. I think even when you're talking about artists like Jay-Z or Jadakiss, these artists are addressing class issues. You know, whether they're celebrating the latest trinkets on the one hand, or whether they're talking about where they came from and what options were available to them on the other. I think class is a huge issue in hip-hop. You have, there's a group, God, I can't remember where they're based, but they're young activists who are very affluent. The group is called something like Cool Rich White Kids, and they're trying to find ways to fund activist groups. So I think there's a lot of ways that class is being addressed, most certainly by artists who are talking about the issues of young people who are seeking jobs in this economy and can't find them. There's a very important study that came out of the Center for Labor Market Research at Northeastern University that found that two-thirds of young people today were their standard of living was less than their parents in the older generation was in 1950. So we seem to be going backwards economically. The IRS did a report that showed the income for the top 1% of Americans was $862,000 a year after taxes, compared to the bottom 40%, which is about $21,000 a year after taxes. And I think that this is the climate that young people are finding themselves in, with college education becoming more and more out of reach, with a public education system that more and more isn't working, and the best job option that we seem to be offering our young people is an opportunity to go fight in Iraq. I think we have to do better, and I think that the hip-hop political movement is raising these kind of questions.
Well, I think at that we're going to finish up because we've just about used our time. For people who are listening, I want to again say, if you're interested in reading some of the writing of our guest, Bakari Kitwana, you can look for his two books. His newest one is titled Why White Kids Love Hip Hop, and it's published by Basic Books. Also, you can look for his previous book, The Hip Hop Generation. He has written for a number of different publications, Village Voice, The Source, The Progressive. He was, for a number of years, executive editor at The Source, the country's best-selling music magazine for much of the 90s. He's also served as music reviewer for NPR's All Things Considered. He's out traveling around talking about his new book and is out on the West Coast. And Bakari, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Today's broadcast is also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information is available on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. If you own or manage a business and you believe that this public radio station is an important resource for your community, please consider making a sound investment, an investment that pays dividends every day of the year. You can call 217-244-9455 right now and enroll your company as a business friend of WILL. Or you can contribute online at WILL.uiuc.edu. And of course, we also need the contributions of all the individuals that we can, because now we're raising the money that will support our programming for next year. And if you're not a friend of WILL, a financial supporter of this station, you as an individual or as a family can do that as well. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. You can call and make a pledge, or you can go online, WILL.uiuc.edu. We hope we'll hear from you, and thank you very much. That's about it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, much more in the way of news, features, sports, weather, another interview, all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Our guest this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program will be investigative journalist Christina Rathbone. She spent close to 5 years visiting some of the prisoners in America's oldest prison for women, MCI Framingham, in Massachusetts. Rathbone is the author of A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. She joins us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Prices are higher on the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's look at the numbers now. July wheat, 327, that up 3.5. September wheat trading at 337 and a quarter, up 4. July corn, 228 and a quarter, up 2.5. September, 237 and a quarter, up 2.5. December, 247 and three quarters, up 2.25. And March corn, 255, that up 1.75. July soybean, 717, up 16 and a quarter. August, 722, up 50.